Namaste. Welcome to Quod Legalis Presents Book Detox. Here we get into conversation with practicing advocates and industry experts and try to present their perspective on various social legal affairs in the digital era. Today we have Advocate Parvati Bakshi with us. She is a 2020 graduate from Jindal Global Law School and is currently working as a legal associate at Civil Amarchand Mangaldas. During her time in law school, she was a part of many extra and co-curricular activities such as sports, moods, and area-related work. She also attended various international academic programs, including a semester exchange at ESAID Law School Barcelona in her final year. Before we dive into our topic of discussion today, it would be great if you could share your experience as an exchange student in Barcelona.
Hi, it's great to be here and great to be a part of this podcast series. So a little bit about my time in Barcelona. I had luckily the opportunity to go for an exchange program in my fifth year, first semester, that was offered by my law school, Jindal Global Law School. And essentially it was a very competitive process to bid for it, and I managed to get the bid and the seat for the ESADE Law School in Barcelona. So the summer, the semester exchange program is a very interesting program which I was looking forward to since I joined law school. I was able to select subjects in geopolitics, comparative law, minority rights and self-determination, cybersecurity, and even real estate transactions. So those were the subjects I took up when I went to Barcelona. And it showed me a very different perspective on life. I had to live on my own, cook on my own. And you're also, managing your own, studies and academics with other international students. So it was a very interesting experience and a great learning experience, and I genuinely enjoyed it. If any of you in law school have this opportunity, how the other international students, many of them knew very little about India. They knew only the cliches that you see in movies. And they had no idea that, we're a very developed country, actually, in many ways. There's, of course, a lot of underdevelopment, but there's also a lot of development. And they were very surprised to know that we're very progressive in many ways. So that was also an interesting experience.
Thank you so much, ma'am. It's really inspiring to know about it, that you had to bid for it and you actually made it happen for yourself. I'm sure it would be an inspiration for a lot of law students who want to pursue their higher studies or even an academic exchange semester in other countries. Moving ahead on our topic of discussion today, that is privatization drive in India. Post-independence India has mainly remained a conservative economy that allowed only restricted and conditional entry of the outside world. But now the Indian economists have understood the importance of coming together with a global economy for growth and efficiency. India is a mixed economy where private and public sectors coexist in leading sectors like banking, telecom, road, transport, education, healthcare, and manufacturing, etc. In recent years, India has witnessed major economic reforms as there is a momentum towards privatization. Before diving into the details, can you please explain what privatization is and what are your views on the current privatization drive?
So essentially, privatization in the most basic sense is the transfer or ownership of property and businesses that are owned by the government to the private sector. And that is what we understand as, and we have termed a business it is, and all the operations, the assets, etc., become owned by the private sector or a non-government party. Now, as you mentioned in your query, our country is a very mixed economy where the private and public sectors have coexisted for a very long time. So in light of this, like, I just want to go back and look at the history of privatization in India. Our development as a country since the British rule has almost been cyclic. We started out with, you know, these entrepreneurs laying the building blocks for a flourishing economy in various sectors across the board. Then the government took over those, you know, sectors or industries and companies. They nationalized banks and so on and so forth. And then we had a moment of liberalization, which was introduced to ensure that the mass consumers that our country has were being catered to. And when that mass liberalization movement was happening, we were also adopting a very strict regulatory framework. Today, we are again going back to a somewhat liberal movement of privatizing stuff and going back into that sort of entrepreneurial laying the building blocks for the next generation to take up and improve the economy. So in the 1950s, our country didn't really have the capacity for building large industries and companies indigenously. The knowledge and skill and talent that was required for such an undertaking was recovering from hundreds of years of colonial rule, a partition, and massive communal divides. So with this very limited capacity, the new government at that time, post-independence, realized that it had to take the reins to pull up India's economy, and it did so with public sector undertakings. Except for banking sector, which was already doing decently well in the private sector hands, but it was also itself subject to nationalization, which is an entirely different discussion. So from the 50s to the 90s, we saw a lot of public sector undertakings, you know, taking the lead and trying to build various industries in India. And in 1991, it was the Narasimha Rao government which launched the new economic policy, which essentially worked on a model called the LPG model: liberalization, privatization, and globalization. It was a very imperative move to launch this policy because it was required because the inefficiencies of the public sector were, you know, deeply hampering the development of our country. So this move for liberalization, privatization, and globalization was essentially to address those inefficiencies of the public sector. The public sector had already achieved what it had to set out to do post-independence, but for it to continue to hold on to the reins would be very irresponsible. And it was a known fact that the public sector was facing a lot of losses towards the end of, you know, getting closer to the 80s and 90s, which was essentially meaning that it was the taxpayers' monies that were going down the drain. So when this new policy was introduced, it reduced import foreign competition into Indian markets. That
Can
foreign
you start competition again from reduced because I couldn't hear your voice.
Okay. I think there's also possibly maybe some issue on your end because your voice was breaking at a couple of times. So maybe you should check your connection.
Just a second, give
you
me.
You want to connect it. Like, I'm having trouble hearing you. Like, your voice is like coming very slow at times. So if you want to disconnect or reconnect your internet, we can.
Ma'am, you can.
So essentially, when the new economic policy was introduced, it reduced import duties, reduced taxes, made entry into the Indian markets easier, and we saw the influx of foreign competition into Indian markets. And it was this foreign competition that injected the much required knowledge, skill, and talent that we were because of the intent of privatization at the end of the day, it is essentially a shift towards companies and industries becoming more efficient and competitive so as to ultimately benefit the consumers, which is the population of India.
So essentially, privatization was a step taken to basically remove, if I may say so, the inefficiencies of the public sector. Am I correct?
Yes.
Moving ahead, the Honorable Prime Minister said, and I quote, "The government has no business to be in business. The government's focus should be on the projects related to the welfare and development of the people. More and more government's power, resources and capacity should be used for welfare work. At the same time, when the government starts doing business, there is a lot of damage." His speech seems to have justified the privatization drive in India as the need of the hour. What is it about the present time and situation that makes it imperative to allow policy reforms in the private sector?
So, in a way, I do agree with the statement he has made, and there are a couple of reasons why. First, in my opinion, one of the most obvious reasons is that our government agencies and institutions are not nearly mature enough nor transparent enough for us to be able to altogether readily trust in them and allowing them to do business. We are well aware of the multiple failings of our government bodies, primarily because of the people within them. And corruption is a leading reason why I personally would not advocate for governments running business. And this echoes back the point about how public sector generally has state organs and having effective administration of the governmental organizations. It was not meant for, they were not elected for dealing with the complexities of markets and businesses and industries. So those inefficiencies would eventually lead to losses. And that is one of my first reasons why I believe that government should not be in business. Second, I feel that our country is in need of a massive infrastructure overhaul. While the last few years have seen significant development in terms of, you know, better highways, ports, airports, energy sector, we are lagging far behind our Asian contemporaries. Take, for example, the recent Olympics. Our country hardly had any representation, and it was not because we lack the skill or the talent, but because our state was unable to facilitate or provide the infrastructure that is required to foster that skill and talent. The infrastructure, services and goods that are required to foster better growth in terms of sports in our country is far too limited for the size of our population. And the same can also be said for the education sector. For example, medical colleges are significantly less in number for the population that we have in our country. And it was a huge failing during the pandemic when we realized that there are such few doctors in our country. And it's primarily an education failing. Even for that matter, legal education, there are lakhs of aspirants that want to go out for law school and want to go to NLUs. But we know that there are such few seats offered in each of those NLUs. So privatization in many ways can be our answer to these failings, subject to, of course, the right sort of regulation and legal framework. Third, we can't look at, you know, this public-private thing in a very binary manner. Privatization is not unidimensional, and there are many ways how the public-private relationship can be useful. And we've already seen this by way of public-private partnership models, i.e. PPP models. And PPP models are very popular in road projects, renewable energy sector, ports, airports, metro projects, so on. And this is something I'm speaking from experience because I've worked on the legal, you know, sort of documents and legal transactions where we deal with a lot of PPP models. So when you pay, for example, a toll on a nice highway and you're passing the toll and you pay the toll, that's an example of a PPP model. The government is essentially allowing private players to bid for contracts to construct, you know, highways or construct metro stations or construct ports, airports, or even solar power plants. And it allows, the government allows these private players to construct on government land and gives them the right to collect a certain amount of money for the next couple of years to make up for whatever they spent on that land, on that construction. So everything from the materials to the systems that are incorporated in those projects is done by the private player, and we get to benefit from those higher quality of roads and metro stations, so on and so forth. So that just goes to show that it is a very, it's a structure, the PPP model is a structure that has done well for our country and is actually improving our day-to-day lives in ways we would never, we don't really think about because we're not aware of it. When you're actually sitting on the legal side of things and you know you're drafting these contracts, you start realizing that, wow, my day-to-day life is actually, you know, being benefited by the overlap of a public and a private partnership. Lastly, I feel that the government has recognized that while some part of the economy has to be public goods, it cannot deny the private sector, because the private sector is what brings out innovation. The government acknowledges that it is not, you know, the right sort of body to innovate. Therefore, they are focusing on providing the platform for private players to innovate. Some of the examples in this case are digital public goods. Aadhaar was a government initiative which allowed private players to innovate on top of it and produce things like UPI, Unified Payments Interface, which then led us to, you know, Paytm, Google, PhonePe, etc. We also have e-signatures and the DigiLocker, which are all, you know, digital services that are born out of the interplay between public and private sector.
Just to summarize this, basically, privatization may help us to improve our infrastructural needs where we are lagging behind. Maybe it's sports, education, or something that is very intricate for our and is a part and parcel of our lifestyle. And it is imperative to have a private-public relationship with a proper legal backing and reforms and regulations to keep everything in, to keep both the sectors in check, probably.
Yeah, you can say that.
Moving ahead, it has been argued that the concept of welfare state may get defeated with the privatization of the economy. Private sector would not care about the society as its main objective is to earn profits, which might result in retrenchment of employees and less social development. Is it not defying the basic purpose of the policy drive, that is social development? And
so firstly, we have to understand that there is no one size fits all for privatization. Privatization models that might work in other countries like, say, Japan or Korea or the UK might not necessarily work in India. And each country needs to adapt the model that suits its demography and socio-economic environment. To say that the concept of welfare state would altogether be defeated is not, in my opinion, infallible logic. There have been many success stories in other countries and nation states that demonstrate how privatization can benefit not just the corporations of the country, but also benefit the long-term growth and sustainability of the country and its economy. At the cost of being redundant, going back to my earlier points, our country is in dire need of infrastructure overhaul, more efficient and affordable high-quality goods and services. And this is something that the government is presently not able to deliver, primarily because of its internal inefficiencies, red tapism, and complex legal and regulatory setups. So, going back to welfare state, what do we actually mean by welfare state? Essentially, it means a state which protects and promotes the economic and social well-being of citizens. It ensures that the principles of equal opportunity and equitable distribution of wealth are adhered to, And finally, that there is some sense of public responsibility for those citizens who are unable to avail of those equal opportunities. There is this notion that the private sector has no intention to keep the welfare of society in mind, and it is the public sector's primary objective to keep the well-being of society in mind. Which is all well and good, but this is not something that's entirely applicable to India. We need to acknowledge that in our country, it is often the private sector which has catered to the welfare of the citizens. Not only has it increased job opportunities, but it has also improved skill training, provided quality goods and services, as well as infrastructure. The private sector has actually been the underlying support system of this country. It's just that we don't realize where the boundary between private and public lies. When you use a metro station, you think it is something the government has provided you. But actually, it is a contract entered into between the government and a private sector player who has agreed to construct on the government land. So the high quality of the service that you're getting there is because of the private player. Now, let me take, for example, the healthcare sector. During the recent COVID pandemic, when the pandemic hit and people were falling sick left, right, and center, did you actually go to a government hospital for treatment? It's highly unlikely, because you are not likely to get an appointment, let alone a bed, in a government hospital, because there are waiting lines after waiting lines in government hospitals. Not to mention, the infrastructure is generally falling apart, and the tendency of government-employed staff is to not really care, because they would anyway be getting their salary whether they went to work or not. On the other hand, private hospitals are the healthcare service providers that have been catering to over 60% of our population even before the pandemic hit. As a tendency, we as consumers tend to go to private hospitals or private centers or, you know, clinics more than we go to government hospitals because of the easy availability and accessibility of private healthcare. In private healthcare, we also see that due to market competition, the private players and hospitals end up focusing on affordable, efficient, and high quality care, which is one of the biggest pros of privatization. Due to competition, market competition, we benefit from best global practices, efficiency, and productivity, which a government alludes to because it's not what a government is meant to do. Governments don't have competition. Therefore, they're not motivated to, you know, improve efficiency or improve deliverability or even, for that matter, quality. Going back to the issue, what I feel the problem at hand is not that privatization will necessarily reduce in job losses or increase costs and so on, but rather, I feel the issue is how do we improve the public-private interplay in such a way that we maintain both the best of both the public sector and the private sector. We have to understand that we cannot abandon one or the other. We should rather focus on where the fractures are in the system and figure out how to fix those fractures. Increased cost of privatization is often can be addressed by market deregulation, which would promote market competition and results in lower prices. Also, a lot of studies have shown that the impact of privatization on job security are relative to the country and the industry. So it's not necessary that if we see in one country privatization has led to job loss, it would also happen in India. Because seeing how privatization is majorly entering in the infrastructure sectors in India, it is unlikely that it would result in any change in number of persons employed. Because we're constructing, you would still need the same labor that the government would have employed. But what's more interesting is that not only are you using the same labor that, say, a government undertaking would have employed, the private partner is more likely to, you know, allow the unskilled labor to become skilled labor, because they're adhering to these global standards, which would mean giving better training, having more resources, having more access to cutting-edge technology.
On the lines of future ahead, as you said, that the real issue is how private and public sector would ensure that the best is being drawn from in each of them respectively. It is a saying that a proper judgment of the value is of utmost importance. So what, according to you, is the way ahead?
So I recently came across an interesting take by the English sociologist T.H. Marshall. He essentially said that we need to realize that the modern welfare state is a mix of democracy, welfare, and capitalism. So while keeping in mind the tenets of democracy and welfare economics, we must not altogether exclude the benefits of private participation in the development of a nation. Speaking from experience, I have seen so many different type of clients who are entering the Indian market, either, you know, externally from different countries, and even we have indigenous players who are, you know, trying to do their best in improving private participation in public goods. And this can really benefit our economy, but it's really difficult for these private players, be them external foreign investors or Indian investors, because they have to deal with such complex legal frameworks. Not only that, there's so much corruption and lack of transparency that the private sector ends up, in a way, giving up, because their input costs and their initial investment ends up becoming so tedious that they decide, you know what, it's just better for us not to invest in India. So, in my opinion, I feel like we need to work on how to make India a good investment, how to make it easier for, you know, local talent, local companies, and also foreign companies to invest in India so as to afford, you know, better services and better, you know, options and opportunities to our population. The private sector cannot afford to be casual anyway, because they are always accountable to shareholders. Whereas the government has time and again, you know, ended up losing taxpayers' money. One recent example is the Air India debt. Air India has a debt of almost, I think, over 60,000 crores. And it's a government-owned company. I mean, a government-owned corporation or airline, which essentially means that that money, that debt, is loss of taxpayers' money, right? And this is something that a private sector player could never afford, because if they start going into losses, you know, the shareholders would haul them up. So, in a way, the accountability of private sector is far higher than the accountability of the public sector. And just going back to that point, that how do we make India a better investment destination? Because the more private players we have, and the more, you know, we work on bridging the connect between the private and the public, then we can also start addressing those issues of, you know, what happens to the labor? Are they being treated well? Is there, you know, fair or equal opportunity in these large corporations? A lot of these other issues we can start addressing. But if we altogether deny the existence of, you know, private assistance and, you know, private funds or foreign investment, then we're not going to move forward
So basically, according to you, allowing investment in the private sector and maintaining a proper relationship between private and public sector is of the essence and a way ahead for future. Thank you so much, ma'am, for such an insightful conversation. And lastly, being a pandemic graduate yourself and working in one of the most renowned law firms, what are your suggestions for young law students?
So, of course, it was very difficult graduating in a pandemic and, you know, joining a very high, you know, high flying job online. But my suggestion would be that irrespective of what the world throws at you, you should focus on doing what you do best. Be competitive, but don't get caught in the trap of having to do what others are doing just because they say this is what you have to do. You will be in law school and you will see your batchmates, you know, going out for moots or debates, or, you know, someone's doing research papers. You should feel competitive and also put yourself out there and try those things, but don't feel that you are underperforming because you are not doing the same as some of your batchmates. Make sure you try to gain as many experiences as possible. Go out for as many internships as you can. Ask your professor questions, ask your seniors questions, be curious essentially. And work on developing what you find interesting and also what you're good at, not just what others say is the popular field of law to follow, for example. And make sure to invest yourself in at least 3 to 4 or at least 2 to 3 different fields of law. Take up courses, extracurriculars and electives within those fields of law so that when you graduate, you can at least comfortably say that, okay, if this career doesn't work out in this area of law, then I can shift to another area of law. So give yourself that flexibility and range. Apart from that, you know, just keep at it, be positive. You have a lot of seniors out there who are ready to help you out if you ever have any problems. So make sure to reach out to your seniors, college seniors, and talk to them whenever you feel lost and not sure what to do.
Thank you so much, ma'am. I agree with you that everyone has their own journey, and one should not do something just because my colleague or my peer is doing the same thing. And this is the first time I came across an advice that one should always maintain flexibility in respect of area of interest in law. So thank you so much for such an insightful advice, and it was an insightful and enriching conversation. To be honest, I did not expect this to be this smooth and this enriching because the topic did not interest me that much, but I learned a lot today. So thank you so much for joining us and for this enriching conversation. For our listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be back soon. Till then, stay safe, keep hustling.